In 1997, IBM's supercomputer Deep Blue defeated world chess champion Garry Kasparov by a 4-2 score in a 6-game series. This was a landmark moment in the development of what we might call thinking machines, as a computer had proven itself better than the best human in what was then the world's most prestigious strategy game. Our guest this week, Christopher Chabris, is not only a cognitive scientist, but also a chess master who covers the professional chess scene in his Game On column in the Wall Street Journal. Chris is going to talk with us about Deep Blue's conquest of chess and how the sport has changed thanks to further advances in AI in the 22 years since. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My co-host is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 4 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in the world of AI automation. Let's get started. The benchmark of a machine defeating a human at chess has mattered for hundreds of years. Famously, the Mechanical Turk, developed in 1770, thrilled and confounded luminaries, as notable as Napoleon Bonaparte and Benjamin Franklin. Simply an elaborate hoax, the human-powered, not-quite-automaton fooled the public for almost 100 years. What made it remarkable was not just the fact it seemed to be an automaton, but it was a seemingly genius automaton, one able to beat humans in the game of kings. Since then, the pursuit of a machine capable of defeating humans in chess was a constant. In fact, the first wave of computer science pioneers, people like Alan Turing, Claude Shannon, and John von Neumann, all were chess players and all tried to make software that could master chess. By the time Deep Blue defeated Mr. Kasparov, computers were already beating humans in chess. I remember, as a chess-playing junior high school student, my 1980s-era Radio Shack brand computer chess set was a formidable opponent, and with various skill levels to boot. Deep Blue's success was merely the crowning achievement, the point at which machine play fully exceeded human play, never to look back. Some 250 years in the making, we finally had a machine that played a prize strategy game better than we did. More recent machine conquests in games like Go, Poker, and Dota 2 make the original Deep Blue victory seem dated. But there's an important difference. Since it happened 22 years ago, we have 22 years of evidence to consider. Deep Blue's victory did change chess, but not in the ways people expected or predicted. How machines and humans coexist in the world of chess offers a tantalizing preview for what we can expect, not just in the future of games like Go, Poker, and Dota 2, but in normal work and life contexts where machine intelligence will be augmenting or replacing human intelligence. While Deep Blue's technology has little in common with modern artificial intelligence, it is an object lesson in how humans and machines will come together. Christopher Chabris was a serious chess player before Deep Blue's victory, and today stays active in the game through the play and training of his son. He has followed the professional scene for decades and also brings us the perspective of a cognitive scientist. He begins by sharing the reaction to and impact of Deep Blue's 1997 victory.
Well, first of all, a lot of people predicted that it couldn't happen or that it wouldn't happen then. So I think there was a lot of surprise at Kasparov's loss. And it's been endlessly debated exactly why he lost that match. He only lost by one game. The final game was very strange. He seemed to play uncharacteristically badly, or at least uncharacteristically for himself. And so it's been fodder for, you know, endless discussions. Some people predicted that somehow this would ruin chess, that once computers could be really good at something, then humans would lose interest, or it would be intrinsically a less rewarding activity for humans to engage in. Of course, the obvious retort to that was, you know, the fact that horses and cars can go faster than humans doesn't mean we don't have, you know, Olympics and marathons and other kinds of sports. So I never really bought into that argument very much. But it was, I think it is true that maybe the intellectual domain could have been perceived differently, right? That the idea that machines can run faster than us or lift more than we can and so on is maybe no big deal. But the idea that they could outthink us would somehow be troubling. But in actuality, nothing happened. The very next month, you know, the chess world went on. And I believe, if I'm remembering my chess history correctly, Kasparov himself, after having been visibly devastated by the outcome of that match and having said some intemperate things that he probably, you know, didn't mean to say or wasn't proud of later on, he came back and won a strong Grandmaster tournament with some of his best games ever, you know, later that same year, and then went on to remain the world champion for three more years, and I think was still at the top of the rating list when he himself retired from from play, and chess pretty much continued on as it had, at least in terms of popularity.
During the interview, when Chris made the parallel between horses and cars being faster and stronger than us, then suggesting thinking machines were similar, I found myself nodding my head. But on reflection, I think they are very different. Humans have never been the fastest or strongest animals. Plenty of other things could outrun or outmuscle us, but we've always been the smartest animals. Deep Blue, artificial intelligence, these advances challenge our primacy. Of course, Deep Blue is no longer the best chess player in the world either, not even close.
Your proverbial, you know, phone has a better computer than, you know, IBM did for Deep Blue 20 years ago. And so in some sense, inevitably, that would have happened, that just the increasing speed and ordinary developments of computer chess would have eventually resulted in computers that could beat Kasparov, whether it was 1997 or 98 or 99 or whatever. There were a few more matches after 97 between other grandmasters and computers, and eventually those matches just became uninteresting because the computers won by too much and the humans didn't really want to play. So having one computer that could beat the world champion that was, you know, stored in an IBM research lab didn't really change things very much, but having everyone with a computer that can beat the world champion certainly has changed things quite a bit. So I don't have a list prepared of all the ways that it has, but one of the most interesting ones, to me at least, is that you can now watch all top human versus human matches and tournaments online in real time. And all the websites that broadcast these events have computer engines, you know, computer chess programs built in, or you can use the one built into your phone to have the game being analyzed in real time.
Having the world-class chess-playing machine move first from the research lab to a normal computer, then from a normal computer to a phone, is what really changed the game. The capability itself was not the world-changing advance. The integration into a handheld device that any and all of us in the developed world could have is where the magic really happened.
This machine analysis, and usually it sort of shows you, you know, the evaluation of the position on the board, meaning, you know, who's winning and by how much. Usually it's in like fractions of a pawn. So if it says something like plus 1.5, that means the estimation is that white is ahead by 1.5 pawns. And sometimes you can translate that into a winning probability. So, you know, if someone's ahead by 1.5 pawns, maybe that means an 80% chance of winning or something like that. So there's all that, and it tells you sort of like what it thinks the best play would be from this position. It doesn't predict what the humans are going to do, right? So it's interesting that it's still basically applying sort of just a, you know, a kind of brute force logic of saying what's the most objective evaluation we can make of what's going on, and what would best play be, which could be far from what humans are likely to do. So in parallel with all this computer analysis, which is nice to watch, just the rise of the internet and the popularity of chess have made live video broadcasts of humans talking about the games available.
It's interesting that mainstream chess software isn't yet predicting the moves of human players. I would have guessed that to be typical by now. It is a reminder of how obtuse current AI technology is. Not a toolbox, it is merely a hammer, doing specific things very well without being able to do anything else. Of course, hammers can be pretty powerful.
They've sort of changed the real-time experience quite a bit. And in fact, so much so that, you know, phones are now banned from chess tournaments and so on because it's much too easy to cheat if you're playing in the tournament. You know, like if you could just go into the bathroom and look at your phone, you could win every game.
It's interesting the ways in which our desire to feel the hormone rush from victory and enjoy all of the benefits that come with being a champion drive us to cheat. Our human frailties in these ways are also some of our greatest weaknesses. Not sharing things like emotional reactions helps computers find paths to continual improvement.
At a deeper level, the influence that it's had has been somewhat on the way the game is played, sort of like on the kinds of moves that are made. So now that you have computers that are really good at chess, you can start to look, you know, at patterns of how computers play, sort of like what kinds of moves do computers tend to play more often than humans, let's say. What kinds of positions do computers tend to go for that humans don't go for as much? So I think one awareness that sort of grew early is that usually there are more defensive resources in chess positions than humans might have realized. Computers are great at defense because they will examine every move and they will not be emotionally affected by the fact that they have a bad position and they're on the defense and so on, right? They will just look at every possibility and analyze it as long as they possibly can. And by doing that, they basically showed that a lot of positions are defendable that humans might have thought were not. So I think computers did have some influence on sort of showing that more positions were defendable, that defense was more possible than people had thought. When you look at the games between the really top computers, sometimes there's a lot of maneuvering that goes on until eventually one side has a clear advantage. And that has shown people, I think, that a reasonable strategy to play, or a more reasonable strategy to play as a human, sort of a meta strategy, is to sort of prolong the game and keep the position from simplifying into an easy draw, and keep on sort of reorganizing your position and going for very small improvements that might be sort of barely perceptible improvements in your position. And eventually, that may add up to something significant. I think there was sort of like the more sort of human school of thought about this would be that you always have to have an active plan and an objective, and, attack of some kind is necessary in order to win. But I think maybe one growing realization from computer chess is that alternate strategies of just sort of, slow improvement, it's really who makes the mistakes often that determines the outcome. And chess is a competition. It's a sport of sorts. And so strategies of maintaining pressure until the other guy becomes the first to make a significant error.
Patience. That is certainly a hard one for many of us humans, myself included. In fact, I was such an impatient chess player that my strategy was to trade pieces as quickly as possible. I knew if I got the total number of pieces on the board down to a certain point, I would have a good chance to win. Oy, I would not fare well against these ice water in the veins, emotionless machines of perfection. You would need to have incredible confidence in your ability to keep the entire board in current and future states always fixed in mind as you make small, incremental moves about the board. Let's pivot to explore how machine chess has changed the way people learn the game.
So it used to be that the way you would learn to play chess better would often be via books or maybe magazines or sort of printed literature. And there's still a huge amount of printed literature in chess. In fact, there are probably more chess books coming out now than at any time in the past. And there are more great chess books coming out and so on. But increasingly, I feel as though I hear strong players talk about how they have very rarely actually looked at a chess book in their life. And the reason is that they have been able to use computers to learn and improve and study, and they don't really need to use books as much. Computers now, they're now programs you can get, anyone can get, that will basically just take a game score, the moves of a game you played, and run it through the engine. Engine is just the term that chess players use to describe computer chess programs that that calculate best moves and evaluations and so on, the way Deep Blue does. You can run it through the engine, and it'll basically annotate your game for you. It'll put a question mark after every mistake you made. It will tell you exactly how much of a mistake it was. It'll say, like, you were ahead by 1.0 pawns here, but after the bad move you played, you're now, behind by 0.5 pawns or something like that. It's like a really good coach, telling you, you should have done this, you should have done that. And that can be very useful for improvement. Just studying and just seeing that, even knowing what your mistakes were, is a big advance over the way things were before, where you would try to sit down and figure it out by yourself later, but you don't have the assistance of the best player in the world the way everybody does now by having a computer, at the ready. You don't have that person pointing out the mistakes, and you could, massively accelerates now the process of seeing what your mistakes are and seeing, at least some information about how you could have done better. Sometimes what the computer tells you is not really very useful information. It just says you should have played this move instead of that move. It doesn't explain why you should have played that move. It doesn't explain how maybe you could be better at finding, those better moves in the future. It just says, here's your mistake, here's what you should have done. But even that is a significant amount of information that is sort of democratically available to all players now, when before, we could only sort of hope to figure that stuff out by laborious work. The computer understands almost nothing of who it's interacting with, and is basically, it's kind of like it's grading your math problems, right? Like you did this multiplication problem, you got the wrong answer, here's the right answer. But it's not teaching you what the good algorithm for multiplication is, or what is it about numbers that that makes them work this way, or anything, at any kind of abstract level. And I think that's a huge opportunity, a huge neglected opportunity for computer chess research. I'm not following all AI research and so on, so I don't really know to what extent this has been worked on in other fields, but computer chess seems like a really great domain for it because it's a complex skill, and we have computers that are sort of tantamount to perfect at it. So a great shift of focus now would be to look at how can we use that oracular chess knowledge to figure out why the humans are making mistakes, not just that the humans are making mistakes, but figure out why they're making mistakes and maybe classify those mistakes. And the computer can say, hey, I see that you often, you know, make mistakes when, you know, there are, you know, two or three of your pieces are unguarded at a time or something like that. So here's a bunch of situations like that that I'm going to quiz you with. That's the kind of thing that a human coach might do. And I think eventually computers could do it too. It's a matter of research effort, I think, being put into it.
This current state of things feels like both progress and incredibly imperfect. Adding the layer of why probably needs human insight at this point, but weaving that human perspective into the software is just a matter of time, money, and will. The market for chess education may not be lucrative enough to make it happen anytime soon, but I think it's safe to say there are not technical barriers to software offering this to the end user, merely limits to what machine learning-generated analysis software can do. So, how has computer chess impacted top-level play?
They've definitely had a lot of impact at the high level, at the top level, because top players all have to be prepared that their opponents might play, you know, some move that was, you know, the computer's best move or something like that. But in a way, you know, sort of like the metagame has evolved a little bit to the point where the top players are sort of now trying to figure out how far down the list of the moves, you know, in the order that they're ranked by the computer, can they go to find something that they think is good, that they would like to play, and that the opponent probably hasn't looked at because it's too far down the list of the computer's moves. So there's kind of this metagame, you know, going on where also the top players can take advantage of a better understanding of how computers actually think and how they, you know, and how they work and so on to know, like, well, the computer suggests this, but I really shouldn't be trying this, or the computer suggests this and my opponent will probably play it, you know, so I should prepare for that.
After recovering from his loss to Deep Blue, Garry Kasparov, considered by many the greatest chess player to have ever lived, embraced machine chess. He pioneered a game called Advanced Chess, or Centaur Chess, that involved humans and computers collaborating. It never really caught on and is a small sideshow in the larger chess community.
At what point does the divergence between the human's ability and the computer's ability become so great that it becomes a mistake to insert the human into the system and let the human decide whether to follow the computer's advice or not, or let the human decide which computer's advice to follow, and so on. In the early days of this, I think the idea that Kasparov had was that there are certain kinds of situations in chess that the human understands better, and certain kinds that the computer understands better, and therefore the optimal combination is to let the human exercise judgment over whether to follow the computer's advice. But that proportion has been shrinking over time, that the proportion of situations where the human is clearly better, or at least, you know, could have the confidence to know they're better, has been shrinking to the point where, you know, you start to run the risk that the human might think they know better when they really don't. Sort of like, you know, overriding the computer when in fact the computer would offer, you know, the best the best chance of making the best moves, or in a more critical situation, you know, where the computer has the best chance of driving the car or landing the plane or, you know, making the right medical diagnosis or something like that, you know, depending on what kind of domain you're talking about. You don't necessarily want overconfident humans to be tossing out, you know, high quality advice when they shouldn't. We already have plenty of examples of overconfident humans tossing out the advice of high quality other humans, you know, and ignoring experts and so on. So we don't necessarily want to transpose that to computers as well. I think it sheds light on the relationship between human and computer expertise, but doesn't sort of seem to create as much of an interesting, you know, sporting conflict, I guess.
We find ourselves back at issues of human weakness. Hubris is certainly not a machine trait, unless we intentionally program it in, I suppose. One of the unintended consequences of computer chess is drastically reducing social interactions and shared analysis as part of the ritual of chess tournaments.
It used to be that even the very top players, after they would play a game, would go to a room and analyze it together afterwards. Nowadays, I think that happens less, and one reason is that everybody just wants to go back and see what the computer says. You don't need some other human being that, you know, across the board from you to do that, or you figure, why am I going to waste my time analyzing this game with a human when we're just going to make mistakes and we could find out what the computer says, which is actually more likely to be true. So in some ways, it may have a little bit of an antisocial influence in getting people away from analyzing the game together afterwards. I noticed going back to real chess tournaments that I was not going and analyzing the game with people afterwards. Now that could be like, you know, I've got a son, I'm busy, I've got a job. Like what I want to do after the game is like check my work emails and check Facebook and so on. But it could also be people view computer analysis as sort of the gold standard. And so why waste our time, talking about the game with other humans? And people have pointed out, like chess trainers have pointed out, that this can be maladaptive for your own improvement in the game. Not just that you sort of lose out on the socializing and everything, which is nice, but that the best way to improve, according to some trainers, is don't look at the computer's evaluation of your game or your moves until you have first written down your own thoughts about what happened. Sort of like, because like once the computer tells us what we should have done, then it's easy to sort of start forgetting why we did the things we did in the first place, because they don't make sense anymore. Now that the computer has told us their mistakes, we don't even realize what our dumb thoughts were during the game. So first write down what you were thinking, reflect on the game, and maybe even try to figure it out yourself, like the way they did in the old days.
That's an important point. Most humans, most of the time, don't learn merely by being shown the correct answer. There is a learning process that we'll talk more about later in season one. But in the ways that computer chess is now being leveraged, the two steps forward of perfect and real-time information is accompanied by the one step back of losing the process that best enabled you to learn in the first place. It's like drinking orange juice instead of eating an orange. You might get all of that yummy juice as much and as quickly as possible, but the pulp, the healthy part, is being extracted in the process. We've talked a lot about Deep Blue and computer chess in a generic sense, but what is the state of the art in chess and AI?
You know, AlphaZero was a computer program that involved specialized hardware that was basically endowed with sort of a certain kind of knowledge of the rules of chess and some constraints on, some constraints on how it would represent the chessboard and so on. And then essentially through self-play and reinforcement learning became very strong at chess, strong enough to beat another top chess engine in a match. And people have looked at the games that have been released by AlphaZero, and they're very impressive games, and in fact may have some insights for humans, at least about sort of what kind of openings are playable and what AlphaZero played some surprising moves in some positions that humans might not have thought of, and maybe other computers wouldn't. So that's all great. So far, not a huge impact on chess itself, because like with Deep Blue in 1997, AlphaZero is a specialized machine that nobody can access except for the people at Google and DeepMind who created it. And I hope one day they somehow let other people access it or access something similar. In the meantime, there's been a sort of open source project started by some of the same people who do open source, other open source chess programs called Leela Chess Zero. I don't know where they come up with that name, but they basically sort of started producing an open source version of AlphaZero. You know, they didn't have any of the code or anything like that, but they just sort of took the same principles that the Google folks used and started developing it. And it's been playing itself, I think, all year, basically since January or something like that, and reached grandmaster strength. Without all of Google's special hardware and so on, it probably just took a lot longer. You know, Google like trained the whole thing in a day or something like that. These guys took months, but still. I think one of the impacts might be that by having essentially a completely different, very largely different computational architecture try to solve the same problem.
Open source is something of an absolute good, and the more that closed corporate-controlled systems like AlphaZero become more widely accessible, the more quickly and democratically advances for all can be enjoyed, whether that be in chess or more in society writ large. As computer chess continues to improve and is now an accepted pillar of the game, attitudes towards it are changing as well.
You might see sort of like another style of play, right? Right now, there's sort of like chess players sort of think they understand sort of the computer style is a certain style, and people will often be able to say, oh, that's an engine move or that's a computer move. You know, sort of that used to be an insult in chess. A computer move was like a stupid, pointless move that computers made for some obscure reason that didn't make any sense. Now a computer move means a move that's like so good and yet so unusual that only a computer would see it and see how good it is. So, but then maybe there will now be another style, which is sort of more of a hybrid of computers and humans.
And what are some broader lessons we can take from 22 years of computers ruling the chess world?
There's some sort of social lessons, right? Like one of them is that when computers get really good at intellectual activity, it doesn't kill the activity. In fact, it may even make it, you know, more interesting and more democratic for humans because it makes the, you know, it makes the availability of top quality performance, you know, more universal. You know, it used to be you needed to be like a child in the Soviet Union to be able to access like top quality chess training at an early age. And that's why Bobby Fischer's, world championship was so remarkable that the Soviet Union had dominated things for so long. Well, nowadays you don't even need to have that much money, you know, or have, have a trainer or whatever. You can really access sort of, you know, top quality analysis. You need to learn, you know, you need to know how to use it and so on. But that's had sort of a positive social effect. And certainly it doesn't seem like people are less interested in chess than they used to be. It seems like if anything, they're more interested. In the chess Olympiad, we've got, you know, China and India are two of the strongest countries now. They, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they were not very strong at all. You're going to have up and coming African countries, I'm sure, soon. And so that's all great. So the social impact seems to have been positive. If anything, it's not a doomsday. It's not a doomsday thing like some people may have worried. I guess another lesson
is that, and maybe this is obvious, so it's not a lesson, but knowing, you know, having sort of an objective, having, you know, a near objective oracle or something that you regard as objective is not the only ingredient necessary for learning and improvement and better decision making, right? Because humans are always capable of ignoring even, you know, objectively good ideas, information, you know, opinions, and so on. So that's not enough. And maybe we also need to learn more about how to make the best use of these kinds of tools. They're new, you know, we haven't had them, you know, around for very long. And even today with sort of simpler tools like spreadsheets, you know, which have been around for a lot longer and they don't make mistakes in addition, multiplication and division, people still misuse them in all kinds of ways. So, you know, overall we need to really learn, you know, how to better use these tools and maybe how to teach people, you know, to use computational tools better and to study the relationships between people and computational tools more.
These are all good reminders that AI automation is not something to be afraid of. It won't quickly kill our work, and it will take time for it to mature from clumsy to effective, longer still to optimal. And we finish with a final word on the role psychology plays in the game of chess.
There is a sense of risk and bluffing in chess. In fact, there's a book called Risk and Bluff in Chess, I believe, where you might make a move hoping that your opponent thinks that, you know, if you're willing to take this risk, then you must have seen that there's a defense or that it's justified or something like that. But that's a bit of, you know, I don't know, that's a bit too high wire-ish for me, you know. Like as Bobby Fischer said, you know, they asked Bobby Fischer, do you ever try to use psychology against your opponents? Do you ever try to, you know, psych your opponents out or anything like that? And he said, good moves. I just play good moves. And that is probably still the best psychology, right? Is to keep on playing the best move is probably still the best psychological approach.
Thanks again to cognitive scientist Christopher Chabri. So, John, how did our interview with Chris impact your thinking about the work we're doing with Creative Next?
Yeah, so one thing that Chris said that struck me was this idea around, once computers, you know, became very good or could, you know, be better than humans at a thing, that, you know, we've sort of made assumptions that, you know, maybe human beings would be less interested in that thing, that it would be less rewarding. The activity would be something that human beings would not want to engage in necessarily anymore. And you know, he you know, was talking about this in the realm of chess, of course, but it made me think about what is it that we do with our activities, with our work, that makes us want to engage with them, right? So the idea that once a computer could beat any human being at chess, that chess would somehow lose some of its value. And, you know, the moral of that story is that didn't happen, right? So chess is still something that is played by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people all over the world. In fact, there are now computer plus human or computer human teams that play against each other in chess. It changed what it meant to play chess, of course. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get into that more later. But what is it that makes us want to engage with something if it's not, you know, the sort of drive to be the absolute best, you know, possible in the world now that a machine can beat you? So from a, you know, the perspective that, you know, the research we're doing for Creative Next, what that generates for me is this examination of the various sort of motivations that we have for engaging in different aspects of our lives, and really starting to understand sort of the different threads that contribute to our human activities. Now, you know, one of those is relationships, right? We have a relationship to each other. You know, if you and I play chess, that's part of that relationship. So it's not just a game, right? It's a game, but there's lots of other elements of context that need to be understood. And so more broadly, as we're implementing AI across multiple systems that affect us as human beings, whether they be in our workplace or at home or as a society, I think we need to understand, you know, the human motivations, you know, what drives our interests, what drives our culture, and a better understanding of that will enable us to use artificial intelligence in a way that's beneficial. Because I guess it's debatable whether, you know, computer chess has really benefited chess as a whole. But
is it debatable, really, based on what Chris said? And you and I, of course, are outside of that. But really, do you think that's accurate? Because that seems counter to the things that Chris was saying.
Whether computer chess has benefited,
it seems like chess as a whole has benefited chess as a whole. How has it not?
Well, I mean, he was talking also about the way that people are learning from computers now and not from, you know, teachers as much, right? Yep, this, or no longer, you know, reading books about chess. So they're very much into this tactical playing the computer to learn. So I think it's a broader question whether, you know, like, is chess a better, you know, intellectual sport, or however you want to frame it, after computer mastery or before? I don't know. You know, my impression was the jury's still out. but you know, maybe it is better. But I think my point is that that's going to apply to a whole lot of other things as we move forward with AI-driven technologies.
Fair enough. Yeah, you know, the main thing around the project I took away was much, much more narrow. I think I liked a lot of the things you were saying, but for me, it was a sort of a reminder that learning is a process. And, you know, we're talking with Chris about chess, and the next couple of guests are about sort of gaming and machines, you know, defeating pros in gaming and pros using machines to get better at gaming. But after that, we're getting into learning, like, in formal ways and informal ways, talking with people who run, you know, educational institutions. And the idea that the computer just giving you the correct answer from on high is not the best way to learn. It's just a good reminder for me heading into that, heading into taking that mindset of learning is a process. It's not about an answer. It's about a
right.
That. So yeah. For me, it was like a nice primer into where we're going to be heading soon with the show.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so what did Chris say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
Yeah, so I think the way Chris sort of framed the context for the the IBM Deep Blue win over Kasparov, the way he framed that context gave it a sort of a new lens for me. I think specifically, he said, 20 years later, your mobile phone has a better computer than IBM had for Deep Blue, and sort of think about the implications of that. And I just thought, holy smokes, that's so we're all carrying. I mean, if that's true, and I think that's correct, we're all carrying, sort of the equivalent of this, Deep Blue in our pockets, right? And what does that mean for us as a society? What does that mean sort of going forward as we get even more powerful computing technology? And it just didn't, it just didn't occur to me, because we're sort of in the thick of it, that, it really is in some ways, miraculous, the amount of computing technology that we all have access to. And I think as this AI software evolves, and sort of becomes omnipresent on our devices that we're carrying with us, you think, that's sort of the next step. So it was sort of a bolt out of the blue for me. I'm like, oh, so you could show up with, basically a mobile device and go beat Garry Kasparov. That's kind of frightening.
Yeah, we talk about the mobile revolution and we're aware of the power of it, but it really is on par with the impact of the internet. Like, the internet brought us all together, compressed space and time, made information immediately available, but it did it on giant boxes we didn't have ready access to. Like the mobile and miniaturization and shifting that to something that's always with us, easily accessible, easy to use, is remarkable. And you reminded us of that very well in this context. The surprise for me was the social impacts that the machines have had on chess, that the sort of process used to be, games are played and then people huddle up as a group and have social interaction around extending those games, that is gone now. And, it mirrors other contexts of, where machines have gone. I mean, if you think we used to play computer games more at arcades, now mm-hmm. we're playing them at our house. We can virtually be connected in some cases to people, but oftentimes not. Games are just being played alone. This shift socially from doing things in public, doing things in groups, doing things with other people, to doing things alone and with machines. Even the sort of meme of people walking on the street with their head down, looking at their phone. Mm-hmm. You're in a sea of people, and yet you're alone in the world.
It's the connected unconnectedness.
It's the connected unconnectedness is right. So, just hearing that in chess as well, it surprised me. And then once he said it, of course, it makes sense. But I guess going back to our second episode and Toby Bassetti, Unintended Consequences, I'm sure nobody intended Deep Blue to result in social aspects of enjoying chess events together becoming solitary analytical activities, and that's what's happened.
Yeah, and so we were talking earlier, and I said, it's not apparent to me that chess is better as a result of Deep Blue, and that's I think just to clarify that, I mean in a holistic sense, right? So what you were just talking about with the social interactions sort of falling away. And then additionally, I think you mentioned earlier that sort of getting the answers from the computer is not how we necessarily learn, right? So what is that? So now we have a computer that has all the answers, but we have no context.
Yeah.
So those are some of the things that I think contributed to my thought there of, you know, on balance, where are we? I don't know.
Fair enough. What did you learn from Chris that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
Yeah, so I thought it was very interesting that you know, he described how people are learning chess, you know, via the software versus, you know, you used to have more learning from books. And, you know, for me, as a lover of books, I find that, you know, they're valuable not just because they have the answer you're seeking in them, but because they also have adjacent and sort of systemic answers in them as well, right? So getting back to the point earlier about are you just looking for the right answer in this case, or are you trying to understand sort of more broadly the you know, the systems or the thinking or, you know, what have you. Mm-hmm. So for me, that engendered, you know, additional curiosity about how people, you know, what is the relationship between people and our computational tools, right? So you now have a chess master in your laptop, right? And so as you know, as I'm sort of considering, you know, where I get answers from, you know, I'm surrounded by books, maybe sort of crack a book more often than Googling for the answer, right?
Like, you're so old school, John.
I am.
Yeah, you know, for me, thinking about human weakness was what I took and am really applying in my life. And specifically, you know, one of the things that makes the computers so much better at chess isn't just that they can ker-chunk so much more, it's that they don't have the emotional reactions to, for example, you know, in chess, being a, you know, I played a lot of chess in junior high school especially. If you would lose your queen, it's a devastating thing to have happen in the course of the game, and it puts you just way behind in terms of the potential strength of what you're playing against your opponent. And I remember distinctly, you know, you lose your queen and you just, oh God, I'm gonna lose. Like you go down this spiral of badness, and the machine has zero of that. The machine is looking at each situation like a snapshot, and the fact that they just lost their queen is immaterial. It's now, here's the board, and how do we best solve for the board? So by removing the emotion, by removing the human weakness and frailty, the machine is more successful at the game. And in the process, the machine has discovered new strategies for the game. So I thought it was fascinating that now optimal chess is much more defensive, much more incremental, because the computer is bringing a more patient mindset, a more holistic mindset. And now part of that, of course, is the computer can keep it all in its brain in ways that we can't. So again, going back to my own experience in chess, because that's the sort of frame of reference I have to call upon, I know there were times when I look at the board at one point and I know exactly what I need to watch out for, what I need to manage, what I'm kind of planning to do. And then something happens on a different part of the board, a couple moves pass, I kind of lose focus on what's happening on the other side. And then, like, I don't take the correct action that I knew 10 minutes before I needed to take and what to do. The computer just doesn't have any of those limitations. So some of that is just processing power, but some of it is just emotion and just being sort of our own worst enemy, impairing our ability to succeed, impairing our ability to be more and to do more. And so that's something for me in my life, that anecdote of chess computers and the gains that they're able to make for lacking those weaknesses is valuable for me. Each episode, we're going to finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, how can we best learn in smart environments so that, whereas chess engines that provide the answers also subvert a healthy learning process, we can benefit from the artificial intelligence while actually learning in optimal ways? Think about that for yourself and feel free to tweet at us about it at GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at goinvo.com. We're also sponsored by Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum. They believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission? Bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is BIF. As a purpose-driven firm, BIF is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most, healthcare, education, and public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at biff.is, that's biff.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter at GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish an article to extend and build upon each episode. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach at dniemeyer, that's D-K-N-E-M-E-Y-E-R, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is at John Follett, that's J-O-N-F-O-L-L-E-T-T. Our guest this episode is Christopher Chabri. You can reach him on Twitter at CF Chabri. That's CFCHABRIS. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the hashtag CreativeNext. And of course, the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. Here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
Actually, when we were developing the AI, I would look at the hands that it was playing and try to get a sense of, if you know, how well was it doing. And I would see these really weird situations where it would bluff with hands that didn't make any sense to me. And so I actually called up my friend who's a better poker player. He plays professionally. And I said, is this a smart move? Can you tell me, like, if this is this something that a human would do? And he looked at the hand and he said, you have a bug in your program. Like, there's no way that it should be bluffing with that in that situation. So I looked at the code and I realized the code looks totally fine. So we called up an even better poker player, one of the best in the world, and we asked him, in your opinion, is this a smart thing to do? And he said, okay, well, this is not something that I would do, but let me take some time to think about it. And he came back the next day and he said, I thought about it, I crunched the numbers, and this is not something that any human would ever do, but it's actually a brilliant move. And he said this bot is thinking two moves ahead of any human.